Hey, yo, what is a cipher?
We want this to have replay value.
The knowledge of the cipher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cipher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cipher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cipher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 189, a talk with It's The Real. Brothers Eric and Jeff Rosenthal, better known as It's The Real, have been merging comedy and hip-hop since 2007, when they began by making short sketch videos poking fun at, and in short order with, rappers. They took their comedic vision and love of hip-hop culture through a bunch of different projects. Sketches, absurdist interviews with artists, podcasts, and even their own original music. Most recently, the brothers have their own podcast, A Waste of Time with It's The Real. They also have a brand new album called Teddy Bear Fresh and an upcoming live show at the New York City nightclub SOBs on February 23rd. We sat down with Eric and Jeff at Crosstown Studios in Harlem. If you're curious about any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what we're up to, on the air and in the wider world. And now, here's the guys with more AKAs than the Wu-Tang, It's The Real. So, you know, I wanted to start by talking about a big moment in your guys' career that, you know, I think really started everything and, you know, got you started in your current path. And, you know, I don't know if you'll ever top it, honestly. And Eric, that's your appearance in Sports Illustrated for Kids.
Oh, yeah, yeah, wow. Sure. Yeah. That was the greatest moment of my young life. Now, it was cool because, you know, we had this basement in our parents' house that was like, it was like a playroom, but it wasn't exactly like, you know,
we had a ping pong table
decked out. This is pre ping pong table, I believe, but yeah. You know, I asked my parents if I could paint, you know, baseball logos down there and life size and freehand, and they said as long as you paint the walls white, because they were like a baby yellow. And and then my brothers, who are 3.5 years younger than me, helped paint, and we covered the walls in white. And then for the next, like, you know, however many years, I would update the logos too. So if like the Milwaukee Brewers went from like the, you know, blue and yellow logo to a more modern looking, you know, green and blue. And
yeah, same with like the California Angels. But how did you end up in Sports Illustrated for Kids?
Well, I think mom and dad were excited about, you know, what was going on, and thought this was a chance to show more people than whoever came over to our basement. So.
So your mom actually was a magazine writer and editor, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
What'd she work for?
Good Housekeeping and
Family Circle.
Yeah.
A bunch of women's magazines back in like the '70s.
Right. Not and Family Circus. There were no running around with dotted lines behind you.
Although I am Jeff, and there was a Jeffy in, in Family Circle. But yeah. She was in charge. She became like an editor because she basically started her own. It was like a special edition of the magazine that then became its own magazine for Family Circle. So yes, she was a boss.
Was being around that growing up, do you think that kind of made you realize like, hey, writing is a job, the thing that people do, like made it seem unintimidating?
Well, I was the reason that her career stopped. I was born and she became a, you know, her new job became being a mother. And she actually tried to go back to work after, you know, a maternity leave, and found that someone was sitting at her desk. And so, yeah. And so her father was a lawyer and thought about like suing, and her job was, you know, basically not even there. And then, but she switched up. So by the time that we really became, you know, functioning human beings, there was always creativity in the house. Certainly we would go on, trips to the Deep South or down to Florida to visit our grandparents, or to Washington to visit our cousins. And she would create these travel books that we would be very involved with in terms of drawing, in terms of
Sort of like, what sites did you see, what license plates, you know, but it was very much not just like a list of things. Like it was a lot of drawing. It was a lot of
creativity was a big part of our everyday lives. And, you know, so she transitioned from being an editor and a writer to then working at a nursery school and doing a clothing line for kids. And so there was a lot of creativity in the house, but not necessarily in the world of media anymore.
You can just say it. She started Baby Fat.
Well, yeah, yeah. That was it. Yeah.
Our mom, Kimora Lee Simmons Rosenthal.
Yeah.
We all know her.
Yeah.
Right. So where did video sort of first come into the picture for you guys?
That's Eric.
Our dad did have a VHS camera, and we would film around the house, you know, silly things. I think initially it was like to capture moments like, you know, the boys are taking a bath or like they're throwing a ball around in the yard.
It was very like Wonder Years,
right.
You know,
right.
The opening.
What would you do if I sang out of tune?
But we went to an after-school center, like a rec center, called mm-hmm. the Purchase Community House. And then over the summer, it was a day camp. So it was called Purchase Day Camp.
Each year, Purchase Day Camp becomes more and more and more the perfect place for your child to enjoy a summer of activities.
And when we were there, they had a photography, radio, and video production class. You would take classes, sports classes, cooking classes, swimming classes, computer classes, lots of different archery and rocketry and video production was one thing that really took me to other places, acting in videos that were made. And these are, you know, basically feature length done by one staff member and then kids who wanted to be a part of that. And by the time I became working age and wanted to work at camp, I didn't want to be a counselor. I wanted to be a specialist, and I didn't want to do rocketry or archery or be a lifeguard or something like that. I wanted to do film and video production. And from that, I became very close, especially with the kids that were my brother's age. And that group of friends, we were all very creative, and we wanted to do all of these movies ourselves. So we did things like Men in Slacks, which was like a take on Men in Black, obviously, with these 70s suits. And we created handmade versions of the memory erasers and
right, and there were like Seinfeld jokes within that, you know, like without
junior mints
and stuff.
And we also did a full on with 40 kids recreation of the Beat It video by Michael Jackson.
Wow!
So we really tried to, like, you know,
you guys were ahead of the curve. This is before recreating Michael Jackson videos became a thing.
Totally, yeah. And it was yeah. And
we
it
were
was
the first.
It was all, it was also before that Jack Black movie.
Be Kind, Rewind.
Be Kind, Rewind. Right. So for us, we were just trying to take advantage of our pop culture sort of influences. We were trying to be creative, and honestly, we lived in our own worlds. You know, like. My brothers and all of our friends would take time within the day and skip out on being counselors or skip out, or, you know, it was called being a junior leader, which was you're still a camper.
You're 13 years old, so you're not like being fully responsible.
So we took advantage of that and made these epic movies that were done and edited on VHS and they just became this big thing. And from there, I used those to focus on getting into a communication school, and I didn't. I went to Syracuse University, did not get into Newhouse, which is the giant communication school, mm-hmm. the famed communication school. I went to the film school there, which actually was much better for me. It was a smaller thing, and I became, you know, an auteur.
And so do those videos exist, the early VHS?
Sure.
Yeah. They still exist.
And for a time,
it wasn't all imagination.
and for a time, my brothers, who were twins, every July on their birthday would invite all of our camp friends over, and we would rewatch those movies. And there was a time that we did a commentary track that we wanted to put together for a DVD on the different movies. And it was, you know, that circle of creative minds really took us a long way, and we still work with our friends from back then, mm-hmm. even today.
And I've heard you mention, Eric, you worked a little bit with Laszlo Kovacs.
I did.
The, you know, famed...
Yeah, cinematographer. Yeah. So I went to Syracuse, and I thought I was going to be a feature film writer and director, and I was looking for any in. I wanted to get ahead of my competition. I didn't want to be caught up and become a production assistant or work on lighting. It was like the mantra was like, if you want to be a director, be a director. And I was like, any way I can get on a film set and be at the elbow of any type of master or someone in charge, I was about it. And I wanted to, the Coen brothers are my favorite filmmakers of all time. And I wanted to work on their set. But there was a film.
What movie was that at the time? Do you remember?
Oh, man. I don't remember. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. It was certainly after Big Lebowski. It was after Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, I'm pretty sure. But whatever it was at the time, there was a union strike. And so I didn't want to cross the line or get in the way. And obviously, like, productions were shut down. So the following, some months later, I was hooked up with Laszlo Kovacs and had the opportunity to work alongside him, just studying his moves, talking to him, getting inside his head and seeing how he worked and how a film set worked. And I got to stand. This was on a film called 2 Weeks Notice.
Sandra Bullock, Hugh Grant.
She's not interested in money or superficial flattery or cheap glamour. So, you know, what would I bring to the relationship?
Laszlo Kovacs, for anyone who doesn't know his IMDb, is one of the most brilliant cinematographers ever. He was on Five Easy Pieces and Easy Rider, Ghostbusters, My Best Friend's Wedding.
Yeah,
this was obviously not that.
This is a lesser work.
And but to be in New York City, to be around a professional set, I met Sandra Bullock and Hugh Grant, and the director was really nice. The producer's really fascinating, and I got
Most importantly, you got into People Magazine.
I did. There was the first day on set, I was standing amongst all those people and looking very cold. And do you remember there was a campaign for, what was it, Bud Light or something like that? And they had all these people with bitter beer faces.
Ew! Bitter beer face! Ew!
I had a bitter beer face in this picture. So it was like my one chance. I'm in People Magazine and I look like I have the biggest frown on my face because it's freezing outside. But yeah, it was fascinating. And I learned probably more then in, you know, my time on set there than perhaps I did in 4 years of school.
Yeah. And, you know, you guys are obviously, you know, bridge combine hip hop and comedy in a way that's kind of really organic, really interesting. And a month or two ago, we had Ben Westhoff on the show, writer.
Yeah,
you guys
sure.
know, mm-hmm. wrote, you know, fantastic book about West Coast hip hop.
And most importantly about us.
That's right. He did cover us in the Village Voice.
We'll have a link to Ben's 2011 article, It's the Real and the Rise of the Rap Nerd, in the show notes for this episode.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he actually, in his most recent book about West Coast hip hop, kind of talks about this period in the early and mid 80s where novelty records, comedy records were kind of indistinguishable from mainstream rap. You know, mm-hmm. you had the Rappin' Duke was on the radio. Da-ha, da-ha. And kids who wanted to start out rapping, like a young Ice Cube, would do parody songs.
Listen up, y'all, because this is concerning a brand new disease called the VD Sermon. My brother walking through the St. Land halls in tight, that's right, cold on my balls. My chosen, I treasure, and I take pleasure to wear my rubber for provincial fashion.
And I was just curious of how aware you were of that tradition, if you kind of saw yourselves in any kind of relation to that, because I think about you guys when thinking about that era.
Mm-hmm. I think that we definitely were fans of Weird Al growing up. Mm-hmm. I think that, I mean, parody records are like basically candy for Jews, like when they're growing up.
That we were aware of them, but not necessarily like trying to do them, even when we were younger. We always wanted to do original stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We always wanted to have a funny bent to it. Like we would rap at camp and we would do our best to sound professional, but still like have inside jokes from within our daily lives, because we always thought like you rap about what you know. Like we weren't trying to put on airs or trying to do something else. This was like, let's make it sound as legitimate as possible, but also as funny as possible so we can bring the comedy and the high-end production. But, you know, we're also coming from, our parents would get us, they would go to the library and get us cassette tapes of the 2,000-year-old man.
Yeah.
But you claim to be 2,000.
Yes, I'll be, I'm not yet, I'll be 2,000 October 16th.
We grew up on SNL.
Yeah, all Mel Brooks stuff.
Yeah.
Steve Martin.
All Groundhog Day. And again, things like what movies matter the most to us. Like,
Dumb and Dumber.
Dumb and Dumber, Big Lebowski. These things, comedy was really at the center of our lives. And it wasn't even like we were trying to be funny. I think there was a natural just sense of humor that we had in our house and that transferred over to the music when we did it.
Yeah. And so Teddy Bear Fresh, your new mixtape. Yeah.
You know what? It might actually be an album. We're working on closing a distribution deal right now.
So. Oh, okay. So
whatever
new,
the
new project, let's just say, use the lingo.
Yeah.
So on the opening track, right, and sort of throughout, but I think it's most obvious on Who's Real, there's this balance between being, self-effacing and kind of finding the humor in that, but also this, legitimate pride in what you guys have managed to accomplish over the past 10 years.
As featured in the New York Times, we're living everything we say in our rhymes.
So who's you?
We're better Jewish rappers than Sean. We're living everything we say in our rhymes.
So who's you?
Eric Sons got me emoji face crying. We're living everything we say in our rhymes.
So who's you?
Jeff's lines, they're fine. We're living everything we say in our rhymes.
So who's you?
And I was hoping you could talk about that, about kind of keeping that balance act up where it's not you're just putting yourselves down so that people would be like, well, why would I listen to these guys? They haven't done anything. Right. But then also not getting sort of too braggy where it might sort of put people off.
Yeah.
Like, how do you keep that?
I don't know. it's tough. Like I think navigating that balance of being like, well, it's funny, but it's also like, yeah, we have done a lot. We have interviewed Stevie Wonder and we have been on the front page of the New York Times art section. It's a weird thing. It's like that stuff isn't funny.
The truth is, like, if you've done anything for 10 years, there's going to be things that people forget, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the truth of the matter is, we did go up to Max B's apartment and do this sketch that has gone way past, the point that we could have even imagined. ASAP Yams, when we first met him, said that was his favorite sketch video. We played Scrabble with Max B.
Who knew that we had to bring a dictionary to a Scrabble street fight?
All right, I guess it is a word. Baby is a word. That's not even how you spell it. It's W-A-B-Y.
That's something that we're proud of and should not be forgotten. If people don't know us, we want to say in this intro track, yes, we worked with Max B. And also, we worked with Bun B on a song. Like, we took a Southern legend and put his career on the line. For him to rap on a song of ours called Girls with the Dirty Souths, about a song, about...
Yeah, women who keep it au naturel, being the world's worst landscapers.
Right.
That was the video.
Yeah.
But, it was about women who keep it au naturel and saluting those women who let their bush grow.
Don't shave that cat.
Got a girl named Camaro, man, she flyer than a sparrow, but she got a tow the bush around in a wheelbarrow. My girl get extra filthy, especially when she give me mouth. I'm riding.
So for us, we wanted to make note of that and have, jokes in there like that we're better Jewish rappers than Shine.
Right.
So we want to put that out there. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And we're self-effacing, saying like, Eric's line or Jeff's lines, they're fine. Right.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to set the tone and have it go through the rest of the project.
Yeah. And the Times article is like literally the first thing you mentioned on the record.
Yeah.
So when that came out, I guess that was probably not long after we talked the first time. It was
correct.
Sort of around the press for the Urbane Outfitters thing. What was that like for you to get, and how was that received kind of amongst, your family? Was that like a legitimizing thing amongst, family, friends, people who didn't necessarily get what a hip-hop sketch comedian was?
I still don't think people know what a hip-hop sketch comedian is. But it was amazing. We have another brother, Dan, who has had real jobs, worked for the Cleveland Cavaliers, worked for the New York Yankees, worked for
Madison Square Garden.
And so, at all these family functions, Dan has a real job. These two idiots are making like YouTube videos and hanging out with rappers and, Mano's showing up at our apartment at like 3 o'clock in the morning in his Bentley. So it's such a distinct separation between this kid knows what he's doing and these two idiots don't.
Mm-hmm. And
which is to say that, like, yes, we had support, but there was just no understanding. So this article comes out And it sort of shows, okay, well, I still don't understand what they're doing, but at least they're doing it well.
Right. You know, like any, certainly with any Jewish family, the New York Times is the Holy Grail.
Right.
And beyond that, John Caramanica is a legendary writer. And our mom is a huge fan of him. And the fact that we knew him, he had reached out to us to comment on a Cameron piece he did in Vibe at the very early end of our career. We had stayed in touch and he always had this interest in profiling us. And when we came to him and pitched him on the idea of profiling us in conjunction with this new project, he was excited about it and put us in the same piece as the Kid Mero.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very, we think, fair to us. But to have that was a humongous thing for us. We did that, by the way. That wasn't like we had management at the time. This wasn't...
We didn't have a publicist. We didn't have...
No, this was strictly like, you know, a lot of hard work. We did our own press run to do all these different things. We left Passover Seder early in Washington to come back in the middle of the night. Like, we left right after the dinner portion of the Seder.
Mm-hmm.
Said to people around the table, we're like, we have to run back to New York because we had something to do the next day. I don't know if it was the listening party or if it was an interview, but we put everything else in the back burner, did not sleep, did not, you know, we just focused on putting this mixtape out. And that was the greatest thing. You know, I have it framed in my room right now. The headline is perfect. The picture was great. What it says in the article really stands out, and that's forever. We were on the front page of the New York Times art section. That's always what we tell people, and that is legitimate. And it's, with all due respect to the Sports Illustrated for Kids thing, probably the greatest point of our career.
Yeah. Right. And the writing on the new Teddy Bear Fresh, you have this, like, you know, I wanted to look at Waco as sort of an example, right? The hook on it. You have, you know, everything is so lit, Waco, right?
Every time we hit the block, earthquake, go. Insurance fraud, the way up, but let's say go. All the way to the bank, left in my AO. Everything is so lit. Waco, Waco, Waco.
Which is funny, but it's also like just, you know, 5-10 degrees from something that would be an actual rap punchline.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So I guess I wanted to talk about that, about, you know, taking something that, you know, like you said, is almost real, almost legitimate, but putting this kind of comic spin on it. Like, how do you do that? Is that like, how do these ideas sort of come up and get?
Yeah, I think that it's such a thing where it's incredibly easy to be like wacky. But I think that we like to root everything sort of in reality, like Eric said. And I think that we want to have bars that are so funny that you're just like, okay, like Fabulous could say this, you know, or like 2 Chainz could say this, but instead it's these two dopes.
And we've had a lot of people at labels over the years, because part of our business is staying in close touch with all the people at the labels and showing our faces and everything. When they first heard the records on Urbane Outfitters back in 2013, they were like, you guys could ghostwrite for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But why give that away when we can do it ourselves? Mm-hmm. We like operating at a high level. We like when rappers tell us that they like our bars. And when we do this show on February 23rd at SOBs, we're really excited about people seeing what we can do on stage. But the fact of the matter is, we went into this and we like to do things 5-10 degrees just left of center. Mm-hmm. You know, we want people we want this to have replay value.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that we've put out something that's pretty successful in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that being said, like, you know, I think there have been times when we've made songs that I've certainly turned down because I was like, these are too Lonely Island-y. Like, these are too, you know, not big idea sort of. I'm trying to think how to describe it.
Well, if you look at our career, everything that we've done, we wanted to be authentic and true to the culture, right? And we wanted to be taken seriously and not do the Little Dickies, the Weird Owls, mm-hmm. the Lonely Island, because then we can be in our own lane. We don't want to do anything that anyone else does. Let us be in that 10 degree left of center lame. Mm-hmm. And we think that's what this is. And Waco, right. by the way, is the next single off the project. The
right.
Big, the big single.
The video is going to come out.
Yeah, and we've shot the video for that and it'll come out very soon.
Oh, nice.
But yeah.
Well, I'm sorry Janet Reno's not around to star in it anymore.
Same here.
Yeah.
Rest in peace.
We were going to fly her up.
But... And the artwork obviously has to be, you know, the
explosion.
Yeah.
Wow. And, you know, actually on that song, there's kind of a line about, you see, just offhand about people biting your wave, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's the real season, bitch, we got the bass. Oh, watching motherfuckers bite our wave, Sharknado. Every time we hit the...
Do you feel like you have imitators? Or
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say so. I think that we definitely carved out a lane like 10 years ago,
mm-hmm.
Or started to carve out a lane 10 years ago. And I think that people have definitely moved in on that.
Names.
Yeah.
Well,
Sean Sotero.
No. But I think if you see there's videos out online regularly by, you know, large publications, by small YouTube sites that definitely bite our style and are not as funny as we do. And you know what? We're happy to stay above everyone else in our lane and continue to move past them. But yeah, I definitely think we don't get our due.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm happy to continue to do things at a high level when other people can't reach us.
Yeah. And so one of the kind of formats of jokes that pops up on this is in a standard sort of hip hop brag, you'll drop a pop culture reference that isn't very hip hop at all, right?
Yeah.
Something like Mr. Holland's Opus.
Yeah.
Swarming like locusts, we're so hard not to notice. Bring the noise, bring the funk, like Mr. Holland's Opus. The riot cops come out when we're playing solitaire. Put your friends against mine, we're not playing fair.
Why does that work so well? What do you think?
I don't know. I think that it's Eric and I always like the idea of surprise. And whether that applies to this, maybe that's what it is. I think that, you know, some people might find humor in, you know, might find humor in being braggadocious. Like 2 Chainz has a very distinct point of view, right? It's, I'm so rich that I can do this.
Diamonds on my teeth, lick the click, never shining. Ate a Caesar salad, I draw carrots in my salad.
I think with us, it's like, well, I'm so, instead of going like to the top, like 2 Chainz does, we just go left.
Right.
So I think that's, it's just a directional thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, we are, you know, our pop culture references are what they are. I think we throw them in because we find them funny. And the coolest thing that we found over the course of our career is that we have a large and loyal audience who also think that we're funny. So this is for the people that can relate to those things and who can get those references, like if it's Mr. Holland's Opus or if it's like Martha Reeves and the Vandellas.
These ladies Martha Reeves on the heat wave. Tough to under my yarns and trying to leave the place. The girl's at the fire bush, so she wanna be brave. She NBA 2K, cause she wanna be saved. I'm yelling fire.
Or whatever it is, if Peter Paul.
Turn the heads like the voice when I'm walking in. A weapon of choice, Christopher walking in. We in the building, about to shut it down.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
You know, we like to put those out there, and then if people also, we don't want to hit people over the head with things.
Right.
Unless it's fire in a crowded room, get the hose, like the hook of that.
Right. Yeah,
we definitely want to hit
not a
right
on the
head
to
the point.
Yeah.
Fire in a crowded room, get the hose. Fire in a crowded room, get the hose. Fire in a crowded room, get the hose.
We've always enjoyed moments when there are layers to things.
Right.
I think that's when you talk about the Coen brothers, that's when you talk about Wes Anderson, that there's levels to this, and if you keep digging, you'll listen to something and be like, oh my, and you know what? And Jay-Z and Kanye and all these guys who we revere.
I think that our lyrics are definitely tailor-made for genius.
Yeah.
Yeah, like it's, anybody who wants to annotate and be like, well, I don't know what they're talking about, like, they're much funnier when you get what we're talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you have the song Metaphor.
Yeah.
Which, you know, as part of what I assume is the joke, is made up almost entirely of similes.
Yeah.
I want to rotate your box like Tetris. I want to get up in your cut, tetanus. Tall and thin, you're like a female Reggie Miller. I guess I'd make a shout, Miller. Girl, you remind me.
Yeah.
So one of the things that you do.
Wouldn't it be great if we were like, what?
Right.
Oh,
I never thought of that.
Yeah. We need to redo it.
I know. Yeah.
you know, one of the things that pops up on that is sort of the use of what's sometimes called the super duper flow, right? It's comparisons without like or as. So just sort of a implied comma and then the thing.
Yeah. I am a super duper trooper, used to the bottom of scuba. So I'm on the grind, skateboard or scooter, till I am the king of my castle, Cooper.
The use in rap songs of comparisons without like or as is sometimes known as the super duper flow, after Big Sean's 2010 song Super Duper, which popularized the practice.
What's your favorite it's the real use of super duper flow in rap?
I mean,
that was such a big year. I'm trying to think.
Well, clearly, like, you know, I mean, the man who created super duper, which is Big Sean. Like, we love that. We still play that mixtape, like, to this day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody has used it.
Swimming in the money, come and find me. Nemo, if I was at the club, you know I balled. Chemo.
Couple girlfriends and they all a little crazy. Coming down the street like a parade. Macy's. Hey.
It's going down. Basement.
Looking like my grandma. My niggas got that ammo. We Jackson and then light up the L. Samuel. Tunchi and this bitch nigga.
Sure. I will say this about that song, specifically about Metaphor, that it does play off that super duper flow, but it also derives from
the R. Kelly song.
The R. Kelly song.
You remind me of a Jeep.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And because we were like, that's so ridiculous. And by the way, the song was not originally conceived as us singing. It was a rap song.
Mm-hmm.
And it had gone through a few different iterations over the years. And we did want to make something where it was so just ridiculous and compare a girl's ass to a metaphor. And if we do the super duper flow within that, it was just sort of a byproduct and wasn't the main joke.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we love Big Sean, we love Drake, we love
everybody who bit that.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. And so has your rapping, you know, or songwriting kind of changed at all since 2013, since kind of the last time we talked and
gotten
Outfitters?
Better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything that we've done, I mean, it's the 10,000 hour rule, right? Mm-hmm. We've put in far more than 10,000 hours in the studio. You know, we work with our best friend, Greg Mayo, mm-hmm. and the three of it's his studio.
Yeah.
And we are in there and can write very quickly together because we have that shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at from those camp songs that we would do till now, it has been a lot of just, you know, getting those reps in and making ourselves better and listening back to ourselves and refining and, you know, production's better. Our rapping is better, and I think our ideas are better. We had ideas that were like Lonely Island. We had a song where we
we're best friends with Phil Collins,
mm-hmm.
and it's a funny idea. It's just not really. It doesn't fit with anything else.
And you know, we had a song called Upper West Side where we teased that over the years. And
I think I saw a video of you doing.
We
doing
performed
that
live. We performed that. Yeah,
Upper West Slide. Yeah.
And it is
like folk dance song. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so it's Upper West Side, and the Upper West Slide is the third portion of the song. It's an actual dance that we did. And
first you push your baby stroller. And you give it to your nanny, and I mean
give it to your nanny. Yeah.
Lean left, clap twice, and then jump the turnstile. Yeah, all that.
First you push your baby stroller, so you can give it to your nanny. And I mean give it to your nanny. Jump the turnstile, even though you got the money.
So it is funny live. It is more parody, and mm-hmm. we didn't feel like that fit in with everything else.
Right.
So I think we've. Like you doing anything, we've found our voice and we found our sort of point of view. And I think that this is even more listenable than the first project, Urbane Outfitters. This is something where it's a full project. For us, it's very complete and comprehensive, and we're very proud of it.
Yeah, I think the first project was probably more concept driven. This one's probably more lyric driven.
Yeah.
And the Jews for Jesus piece remix that's on there,
that,
you know, the gag is there's a sort of space for a Rick Ross verse, but he doesn't get it back to you. And
in
so
time,
you sort of do some funny ad-libs.
Something, something, something rough. Something, something, Maybach music.
something, 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 folks. Something juice for Jesus, please.
How real is that? Did you actually try to get a Rick Ross verse on there, or was the whole gag sort of conceived that way? That
no, we, well, so, okay. We put out a song called Jews for Jesus Peace, which was a just a single song, not affiliated with any other musical project.
Right. I circumcised a couple links, been ballin', says my necklace kosher. Throwing diamonds up a city, Kanye on a roller coaster. Jewelry.
We shot a video for it with Ian Rex Arrow Wolfson. It did very well. And we did want to get Rick Ross on there. And we did reach out and have discussions with the Maybach Music people and our friends on the label and try to really make that happen. It didn't, but every time we performed it live,
we would be like, oh, well, you know, we have this third verse. It's coming, you know, from really big star. And then we would
Jewish name in hip hop.
Yeah, Jewish name in hip hop.
Rick Ross.
And so we would do the song. And every single time we were just like, well, this is way funnier.
And then if he weren't actually.
And it got such a great reaction. Yeah. And the first part of that.
This is where Rick Ross raps.
Derives from Atlantic Records. Well, Justin Timberlake had a song with T.I. on it. And it leaked.
Right.
However many years ago. And the internet version that leaked
would say Atlantic Records
had the watermarking on it.
Yeah, so Atlantic Records, TI clearance.
Atlantic Records, with TI clearance. I ain't trying to get it, JT. I don't know what she has to say for, man. Hey, shot it cool as a fan on the new once again, but he still has man.
And that would be repeated.
For My Love. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we always thought that was the greatest thing. And when you hear My Love, the real version, it feels like there's something missing.
You almost want to replace it.
So
it's the same thing with Ciara had a,
had
a version of...
There was some song that she put out and it was AOL.
Oh, Promise. And it would say AOL Music.
Yeah.
First Listen.
AOL Music. First Listen.
And so that would play. And every time I hear Ciara's Promise without that, mm-hmm. you want to fill it in.
So we were like, all right, let's do something like that for that. And we stopped trying to get Rick Ross for that because we thought it was funnier the way it is right now.
Right.
And that's not to say that we won't get him for something else, but for this joke,
So your musical collaborator, Craig Mayo, obviously comes from a pretty great musical lineage, right? His late father played with Peter Frampton for years. Mm-hmm. And
Hall and Oates
and Aerosmith and their Joe Perryless years. Foreigner and all kinds of stuff. First off, do you have access to the stems of Waiting for a Girl Like You? And when can we expect to hear you sample it?
Honestly, maybe. we've definitely heard Marvin Gaye stuff.
He has some amazing stems in his Pro Tools, which are incredible. But Greg Mayo is... The musical talent does not fall far from the tree. It's pretty great. There's a bunch of amazing platinum and gold and every other record in Greg's studio. Right. And
all 14 platinum records for Frampton comes alive.
Yeah, you know, it's.
But I mean, if you want to hear the stems for Waiting for a Girl Like You, like I'll just sing it. Like,
so, but it's pretty great too because you know Greg came up off that Stevie Wonder and what else, Foreigner and Hall and Oates and to do hip hop, which we talked him into when we were kids, has been a really wonderful evolution, and I think you can clearly hear. Rhythms and melodies and soul and all these things that came from his childhood too and his experience and his father's hand in the music that we make. And you can also hear, by the way, the progress that he's made, especially in the drums over the years.
Taylor Swift killed Kanye. Girl got a dark side chilling at the playground, so everybody let her slide. The blonde played dumb and turned around like lazy Susan. Cries and crocodile tears and says Kanye can't handle but now.
You don't want beef with us.
Our friend made us.
We bring the streets with us.
Our friend made us.
We carry heat with us.
Our friend made us.
You can't compete with us.
Just how it sounds.
Let's hop deep back again.
Ha
Howard Hughes.
Mansions and private planes, Howard Hughes. Never talk or look at us, Howard Hughes. Kleenex boxes, don't touch nothing but the news. Indoor boys, we balling out, Howard Hughes.
Oh, right. I guess if he started out as a rock guy or whatever, yeah, he wouldn't necessarily be like...
And so at the end of Metaphor, by the way, we were like, we just want to have this vamp that sounds like we sampled that for the rest of the song. And let's just like have him replay it in a Hall & Oates style at the end. So we did.
Nice.
Yeah.
So, Dave Matthews Band's, obviously, yeah. So the street single from this album.
Yeah.
Disrespectful money, paper keep cutting my hands. Counting white faces, I got Dave Matthews Band's. Band to make a dancing Nancy. Dave Matthews Band's.
In the video, there is quite a collection of Dave Matthews Band's t-shirts. Are those all from your personal collection?
Oh, man, I wish. unfortunately, so I didn't grow up listening to Dave Matthews, really, which is like a sort of... You know, a shame because I'm from Westchester and everybody was listening to Dave Matthews. And
wearing, I did, by the way.
Long socks and flip flops. But no, we actually got those from eBay. And also, we also got the hemp necklaces.
Things, yeah.
Yeah. All like shipped to us like that a day before.
All my Dave Matthews shirts from when I was heavily into them in high school and college have gone to better places. But I did, and they were also ill fitting and all that. Right. These were. These looked better. These also showed up on time, and yeah, we were happy to.
But how many Dave Matthews shows did you go to?
A million. I went to so many Dave Matthews shows. I went to so many Dave Matthews and Tim Reynolds shows. And
oh wow, you went to the duo.
I did
duo shows.
I slept in college. I slept out. So I went to Syracuse, and you know the weather can get so cold up there. I slept out in the middle of downtown for tickets there. Slept out in the cold on a couch. That these kids brought and took out of this van and just dropped there. And they were like, hey, man, you can use it. I was like, oh, this is amazing.
How much Abercrombie & Fitch were you wearing?
So much. Everything Abercrombie & Fitch. Everything Abercrombie & Fitch. And I was, although not enough layers because I froze that night.
Yeah.
But it was, it was like 0 degrees out. And I got those tickets and it was an amazing show.
Amazing. So finally, one last thing about the album before I kind of get into some other stuff you guys are doing. Mm. Sure did. You guys shout out, whatchamacallit, candy bars.
Yeah.
On tilt, I got George Costanza's wallet. It's the real Ben had bars. Whatchamacallit? Girls like my man.
What's your personal favorite kind of second tier candy bars? Yeah.
Oh my God. I'm a huge Twix head.
I would put that in the upper.
I want to just say like where my perspective comes from.
Oh, okay.
I did just have some Sweethearts and Nerds, which taste like battery acid as an adult. I was just like, this is disgusting.
Right.
Second tier candy.
From my second tier, clearly whatchamacallit.
Right.
That was, you know, what I name checked.
That was from real life.
That was real life
experience.
Yeah. I think too, I would say Three Musketeers is a second tier.
I would say it's first.
No, I would say it's second tier.
I would say I fuck with Crackle.
That's serious second tier. Yeah.
I fuck with, man, I'm going to have to think about this. This is going to take a while.
But yes, whatchamacallit, because we got bars. You know,
right. Yeah. And so you guys, you know, although as much as I hate to talk about the competition, have a podcast.
We do.
Yeah,
and
we do.
But this is actually like, that's a joke, but there is also something serious in that the kind of music you guys did and the sketches that you did, no one else, at least at the time you were doing them, was really doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other people in the, you know, sort of broadly speaking, hip-hop podcast space.
Name one other podcast.
So what is it like to actually have, I don't know if competition is too stiff a word, but other people kind of in the, you know, doing a similar thing as for maybe the first time?
Well, first, I do want to go back and talk about candy for a second, which is to say that Kit Kat sent us a ton of Kit Kats, because I just remembered this.
That's because we're top tier artists. So,
yeah. Kit Kats sent us a ton of Kit Kats, and they were all melted because it was in the summer.
Right.
And,
yeah.
And
you
so
think they would have figured that out.
Yeah, no, but they were like all congealed into like weird shapes and very hard to eat. So that I'm now putting that in the second tier because it was so whack. Anyway, to answer your question, what is it like, you know, with competition? I mean, it's fine. I think that everybody sort of has different voices, weirdly. Mm-hmm. I think that we don't really fall into the same sort of conversations that even Combat Jack or like Rap Radar or you guys or anybody else, you know.
We
also have different guests on.
Yeah, that so the frustration would come from Mac Miller's doing a press run and everybody gets Mac Miller, you know, and he has a story to tell. And that I get it from the artist perspective. We're doing it right now, right?
Yeah.
But also from the other side of it, it's like, well, you want everyone to listen to your conversation with that artist. So you hope that you're not going to jump in and have Timbaland coming over and then Rap Radar gets him instead of you. The hope is now that you have a distinct voice and that you can get guests that are distinct to your podcast.
Right. But that being said, so, you know, we're on an upcoming episode of Combat Jack. Mm-hmm. Combat Jack did not ask us about Candy or about Sports Illustrated for kids or about any of the stuff that you've brought up. Like, this is a completely different conversation. So I do think that it's possible to have different conversations, but with the same people.
And then for us,
I do it every day.
We prefer to, you know, we've tried to figure out what is our lane in this thing. Because, again, we don't want to fight over the same guests. We don't want to have, certainly won't have the same conversations. But we have tried to go for more of a industry look.
I was going to say you guys have kind of the insider thing.
And we like to put people, we had Sycamore on first. Mm-hmm. We had Young Sav and Steve-O, who are big industry execs.
Yeah, we had Sherry Bryant, who was working at Rockefeller when she was like 17 and then has made the careers of everybody from like Meek Mill to helped with Jadakiss. And then, you know, everybody.
And even today, we put out an episode with Mike Carson, who is Big Sean's creative director, and it's a different perspective that people just don't hear every day.
Yeah. So I guess that it kind of gets into what you do differently than other shows. But as you were thinking about starting A Waste of Time, did you sort of make an effort to listen to other podcasts in the space to find out what they were doing, or did you just kind of go forward with?
No, I think that, you know, we have a sort of good idea. Well, also back then, Joe Budden was around. Mm-hmm. Rap Radar was not around.
For us, we didn't...
Well, you were doing podcasting for the first time.
Yeah.
We did have a podcast
2011,
before.
2012?
Yeah, something like that. But now, you know, it's something where we know ourselves better. We have, you know, we're fully formed humans at this point. So we know how to have a conversation better than we used to. And we want to make it artist friendly and put the light on them. So that's what we've tried to do. We've cut out the cooking.
I was going
to
say, you dropped that pretty early on.
We did. It's a lot. It's a lot.
We did it for probably like 20 episodes or so. Like,
but
it's
a small apartment.
You try cooking for people every day. And
and
them
switching it up. And, you know, we're not the most
how very quickly it'd be like, hey, here's French fries.
Also,
it got to a point where
we got cookies and tea.
Yeah.
Like, Bridget Kelly.
Just Blaze came over and our friend Phil Chang, and they were going to talk about Star Wars because we also like to tie it into the conversation. Like, we were like, oh, you know, we made Seabass for Gunplay, for instance.
I'm at the round table. Where your seat at? Where your plate? Where your lobster? Where your Seabass? We ain't never left.
We made lox and bagels for Jadakiss.
Or rather, we bought lox.
Yeah, he didn't actually have the lox because he had never had it before, and he didn't like it.
But yeah, when
we had
Just Blaze and Phil
over.
Had
lox. So we had Just Blaze and Phil over. They were going to talk about Star Wars, and so Eric and I were thinking like, well, what can we have? What can we make? And finally, we were just like, well, there's like Dippin' Dots,
which
that's the ice cream of the future.
So the whole episode was based around us having never seen Star Wars. Mm. None of it just wasn't an interest to us. Just didn't care. So we were going to have Phil and Just tell us what we've been missing. So the tie-in was Ice Cream of the Future.
Yeah, we're thinking this is a genius idea.
And then?
First of all, you can't find it like anywhere around us.
Well, certainly not on like an hour's notice. And
So anyway, we think it's a genius idea. We finally, I think, get frozen yogurt or something.
No. What happened was we couldn't find it. So we got Ben and Jerry's. We got like 3 pints of or four pints of something.
Right. Anyway, we sit down, we think we're geniuses, and Just Blaze and Phil tell us that it's actually in the past.
Star Wars takes
place. Oh, right, the opening words of the whole movie. Yeah.
No idea. Right.
And we're like, oh, well, whatever, enjoy the ice cream.
So anyway, cooking is no longer a part of the podcast. There was a time when we had, there was an episode we didn't put out with
Lil Durk.
With Lil Durk, and the apartment, this was a summer episode, and the apartment was so hot, and we made hamburgers and fries. We made all this stuff, and homemade fries, we did everything, and the oven in there was so hot, and the stove was so hot, and the room was so hot, and there were a million people in there. It was like, what are we doing? We're all sweating sitting there, and it was just not a good situation.
Not a good vibe.
Yeah. One of the things I've noticed you guys do differently than other shows is you spend a lot of time, you know, the beginning, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 minutes of the show sometimes is about a person's childhood before they start in the industry.
All the way to the beginning.
Okay.
You're born and raised in Columbia?
Well, I was born in Charleston, raised in a small town called Monk's Corner.
Right.
Yeah, Monk's Corner population's like 9,000, something like that.
And how big was your high school class?
Shit, I don't know. I finished high school in night school.
Really?
Yeah, so I have no idea.
Is that kind of a conscious thing?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, that all matters. You know, you sort of set the base. Just like in the same way that you do, I think, you know, you talk about weird things from our childhood.
Yeah. And for us,
or not weird things, because we're very much inside
everyone does that.
Right. Yeah.
We want to, you know, you guys know, is you come into a home, there's something to be said about conversation in a relaxed scenario. That's not a sterile radio studio.
Right.
We want to take people through the arc of someone's career and show that they're relatable and show that you can do it too and drop in those gems along the way. Because sometimes a person doesn't even realize. They're like, oh, yeah, this was a big part of my life and this did make me into who I am today. And I think our podcast ends up being a little inspirational in that when people listen, they're just like, it is possible to come from nothing and turn myself into something.
Definitely. And so on the sort of the business side of your podcast, you had a deal with, or I don't know if it was a deal, but you had some kind of relationship with Fullscreen for a while. Yeah. Uh-huh. But I haven't heard you mention them lately. Their YouTube channel has, you know, the last clip they have from you is months old.
Right.
What is going on with that?
Okay. So Fullscreen, if people don't know, is a YouTube talent company. So they would manage all these, the advertising and everything for all these YouTube stars. And then when they were like, you want to know what? We're tired of paying YouTube, like giving all this money away to YouTube. They were like, we're going to set up a new service that's sort of similar to Netflix. And we were the first wave of talent that was brought in for that. So it was us and about 12 other LA-based 21-year-olds who are like Disney stars. And then these two grizzled guys come in wearing all black and being like basically like smoking cigarettes. So that was the lay of the land for Fullscreen.
Yeah. Okay.
So we did the episodes. We signed a 26 episode option with them. And if we wanted to continue it on our end, then we could. And if they wanted to continue on their end, they could. And you know, if we wanted to together, then that was fine. But we felt like we weren't bringing any listeners over to them. They weren't bringing any fans over to us. And so we ended up stopping. But before that, the best thing about the relationship was, one, they redid our apartment.
I was going to say, do you get to keep the remodeling?
100% get to keep the remodeling. And so, you know, they asked us if we were married to our IKEA table. We said, nope, you can take that out. And they redid it. And it was amazing.
Yeah. I think the other important thing about this relationship with Fullscreen is that we got to prove a concept that we could actually watch this and make it entertaining rather than just listen to it as an audio thing. Mm-hmm. So it was where perhaps we didn't quite make as big a dent with their audience as we would have liked. We are now working on taking that proven concept to other video places, other platforms, so that we can do that again and maybe appeal to the right audience this time.
Nice. And you guys have a, on the audio side, have a deal with the loudspeakers
we
network.
Do.
How did that come about?
Well, so we sold the show to a network called Sideshow Network, which was mostly comedy. At a certain point, we thought we needed some, and that they were based in LA. We needed, and so that was always somewhat of a process in terms of they're 3 hours later, they're far away. We needed people that we could see every day, and we needed people that were perhaps in our space and could do a better job selling ads for us.
Like, you know, understanding what hip-hop is, understanding where we fit into the hip-hop world, like mm-hmm. all that.
And so it was a lengthy conversation with the loudspeakers guys, and it was something where eventually it worked out in terms of, you know, we made sense for them, they made sense for us, and we figured out a deal that is just in the beginning, you know, stages right now. I think we joined in November,
mm-hmm.
and if you look at our traffic, it's done very well for us. We'd like to start appearing on more
of their shows,
and we'll see if that can help grow the audience.
One of the sort of infamous things on your podcast has been the Migos episode.
Yeah.
We've heard, you know, 20 or so minutes of it
mm-hmm.
That you had to package with another episode because you ended up the usable part ended up being so short.
Yeah.
And then you had, you know, the 5 minutes of ad libs sort of video that I think was the biggest success of that episode.
Wait, what's your guys' favorite ad lib?
Mama. Woo.
What happened in the part that we didn't see?
Do you remember? It was just they were not in a good mood. I know that.
Yeah, it was just like very. The first question. I don't remember what ended up in the episode. I do remember that the first question we asked, we were like, "Hey, so like, how did you end up living on a golf course?"
Because there was that Vice documentary series called
Life in Atlanta or something, mm-hmm. or Noisy Atlanta or something, mm-hmm. Noisy Atlanta with Thomas Morton,
mm-hmm.
and so he went down to their house right outside of a country club, and he is standing there and he's going over, you know, it's a beautiful house.
After the shoot, Migos invited us back to see their new pad, though we thought they might have given us the slip since it seemed highly improbable that Migos live in a country club in suburban Stockbridge.
Okay.
Hey, have a great
Migos in there.
Night.
Thanks. Alright. So they do live in a country club.
And you know, there was some trouble that they got into because of that episode, but I was just curious. I was like, how did you end up on this golf course? And Quavo literally goes, "Why do you know that?"
So
forgetting that it was on bluffing that it was on, television.
So basically just being incredibly difficult the entire time. Like they weren't there to play around.
I'll say this. The Migos that everyone knows and loves today, successful number one album in the country. This mm-hmm. was, you know, what, a year and a half ago. This was not them. They knew, I think, that they were not going to sell a lot of records on that YRN project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They came in with a million people. It was not good from the jump.
No. They were uninterested in talking to us.
You guys had to do a couple of songs because Offset is currently not with you. He's not here.
No, Offset not with us right now, but he'll be home soon.
Do you guys have a date? Is there any
just wait on it.
Okay.
No date. You know what I mean? We don't want to put nothing on my boy, so he'll just pop up. You know what I mean?
It was at the end of the day.
But a year and a half in, they know how to, you know, operate. Certainly spirits are better when everything is working. So, we were talking about this 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. If we were to do this interview again, it would be way different. I'm sure they'd be in a better mood. Also, Offset was locked up at the time.
Yeah.
Right.
So different vibe. They're much happier now, seemingly. And, but it was something where we were just like, what are we going to do? Because for us, that was such a great look to have the Migos who, you know, we loved their music and they were going to come over to our apartments, like off of like seemingly big singles at the time.
Yeah.
Not like where they are today.
Not Bad and Bougie, but so they came over and we'd also had Gunplay over like 2 days before. And Gunplay was amazing.
Right. That's a great episode.
Gunplay was like the best.
Yeah.
I would be basking in that.
Yeah, yeah.
I would be fucking snorting an eight ball off my bitch booty crack and chilling. You know what I'm saying? Mm. I won't have no problem, nigga. I don't give a fuck if you right, you didn't right, you flew, you sunk, you swim. I don't give a fuck. It's just me. Mm. You know what I mean? But you know, I had to go through a lot to.
Sure.
You know what I mean? So I appreciate the lemon on top of the sea bass. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the knife and the fork. I appreciate the microphone cushion right here. I appreciate the water. I appreciate being above ground every day.
You sound like a Buddhist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Should have been. My belly's getting a little.
And so you come in on this high where you're just like, oh, well, I can have a great conversation with Gunplay, who has all of his assorted history. Mm-hmm. And you would think that that the Migos would be similarly fun, and it was just...
Yeah, not that.
It was a very tough audience. They were not there to laugh, and and yeah.
But having done 100 and something episodes at this point, it is cool to just have their name there.
Right. Yeah, it's a better picture than it is an episode.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Nice. And one of the things about you guys is, at least in public, obviously I can't vouch for privately, you're sober.
Oh, right? Yeah,
you don't,
yeah.
You don't drink, and all the times I've seen you out at different stuff. What do you think that does, being in these events where, you know, let's be honest, a lot of people are just for the free booze.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And you're...
Maybe that's why
sober.
We get invited everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, we're
not going to drink up all their booze. Yeah, right. I think it's more of a...
I think that it's the one thing that sets us apart.
Well, I mean,
that and our looks.
Look
and,
at us. Yeah. Yeah.
No, I think that whenever people say to me, like, oh, you know, I'm sober for January or whatever, and I hate going out. And it's just like, well, I do that every day.
It's, yeah. For us, honestly, it's people like, they know us at this point. You know, I don't think it's anything crazy when they see that. And, you know, we don't spend $1 million every night on drinks. It's mm-hmm. It's cool for us economically.
That being said, we have been sponsored by Ciroc.
that is true.
Right.
And but no, there's also, I mean, there's a lot of rappers who don't drink.
Well, and the more and more you're
some of whom
things.
Have like alcohol brands.
Right.
Like 50 Cent doesn't drink.
Right.
ASAP Ferg doesn't drink.
Yeah.
So it's and those guys are put in rooms, I'm sure, that are much more pressurized.
Right. So, you know, overall, we're just like your favorite rappers in a lot of respects. So.
Yes.
Nice. So a few days after people hear this,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you will have a live show
yeah.
at SOBs on February 23rd.
Yeah, yeah. Be there.
Yeah.
It's on sale now.
Honestly, like, you know, we've been talking about this a lot lately. We're 9+ years into our career. It's gonna be 10 years in August, and we are going to be living out a dream of being on stage at SOBs. I mean, we're headlining it. It is branded as ours. We've come up with this hilarious name, Your Girls Tour. We are, you know, we're going to be rapping new music, old music, telling stories, bringing special guests. Just Blaze is DJing for us. Combat Jack's hosting. This is a night that is a celebration of our career. It's mind-blowing that this is happening, and we've worked really hard to get here, so we're so thrilled that we've gotten the response we've gotten so far. Now we're working to sell it out,
mm-hmm.
and we feel really good about that, but we really want to sell it out, because why not? Let's make history. We're not just there to show up.
Right and
we've both been to a lot of shows there. So
I was gonna say, SOBs for people who aren't in New York has been sort of the venue where people go from underground to mainstream. And just like a showcase at SOBs is generally has been historically a tipping point for a lot of people. A lot of shows you've been at, a lot of shows we've been at, like Chance and, you know, even Drake and Kanye West and all these people is sort of, you know, the big New York showcase at SOBs has kind of been a tipping point.
Yeah. I'm just so happy that you were talking about how much hard work we've put into this, because I was like, man, Sean has gotten us the most gassed of any like conversation I've ever had. Talking about the haters, talking about, you know, all the stuff. So yes,
but it really is something where we've gone from Greg Mayo's mother's basement performing for, like, you know, 25, 30 of our friends to this famed large room mm-hmm. in New York. And you know, we performed at Bonnaroo. We performed last a year and a half ago at the Gansevoort, when this concert we called the Yolono Tour.
You Only Live One Night Only.
Yeah, where we brought out everyone from Bun B to Bridget Kelly to Joella Ortiz to Clark Kent to Smoke Dizza to...
Jin the MC.
Jin the MC.
Because we were like, we need a Rough Rider to come out.
Yeah. Right. And this is a, like the New York Times article, this is a note of legitimacy for us. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, our family won't get it. You know, our extended family won't understand it. But for the community that we love and respect to be up on that stage on a night like this is it's amazing.
So, Jeff, I have a question for you. Mm-hmm. Is that fake MySpace page you made mocking people in your town, is that still up? and what name did you use?
I'd imagine so. I don't remember the name. It was definitely something that was probably Italian. Or Jew, I don't know. I do remember the picture was like of a super jacked dude. but yeah, I think it's still up. I don't know. Is MySpace still around?
maybe, probably.
Justin Timberlake was like trying to fund it a few years ago to make it like a big thing again. I don't think that happened.
Right.
So yeah, please add me on there. I need a new top 8. All that. Yeah. Please.
Right. We need some new stickers.
I'm streaming my music on there. I need plays up. I don't know. When was the last time you went to MySpace? When did I even mention that? Did I mention it to you on the old podcast?
No, in another older interview, you kind of talked about it.
Yeah, talking about seminal moments in my life.
Yeah. Well, no, I thought it was funny. Just kind of like you said, you were kind of mocking like meatheads in your town, basically.
Yeah, basically. I mean, like it was...
That said, we hope those meatheads all come out to SOBs on February 23rd.
Yeah, but they got to buy 2 tickets because their arms are too big.
That's right. Let's sell it out.
One for each gun.
Yeah.
And, you know, something I've been curious about, you know, you guys have mentioned a lot, a story about something that happened where someone threw a glass at Eric's head.
Yeah.
Can you finally say the name of who it was?
No, but no. I'll say that it is an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
You know how Carly Simon says,
right. Yeah,
it's your very own. Yeah. So vain. Yeah.
Yeah.
In 2015, 43 years after the song's release, Carly Simon finally revealed that the second verse of her song, You're So Vain, was about Warren Beatty, as if anybody doubted it at that point anyway. The identities of the subjects of verses 1 and 3 are still unknown. Simon did say it's not about Mick Jagger, who did sing uncredited backing vocals on the song, but some of the other rumored subjects are David Bowie, David Cassidy, or Cat Stevens.
No, I will say, though, it was it's an entrepreneur and a rapper.
Yeah, it was a rapper who had just gotten out of jail.
And the two of them, we were going to a show in New York during a big music week. Mm-hmm. And at this event, we went to go say hi to our friend DJ Green Lantern. We went downstairs and these two folks showed up and were not happy to see us because of a video that we put out, which, again...
had been put out like 6 months earlier.
And also, by the way, it was something where it was like we went hard at this person, but it was for good reason. And then it ended up being this altercation where we were just like, what are we doing? Like, mm-hmm. What are we doing? Like, why? Why are we here? Why are we doing this? And then it got worked out to whatever degree. And years later, we ran into him. Oh, also, no, he did say to us, whatever, all this stuff. Like, I sleep with a gun by my bed. Let's take this outside. whatever years later we sort of like, you know, cross paths again, and
he shook our hand. Well, he came over and he was just like, hey, you know, I'm glad that we're both still here or something.
Right but we like, have
not an apology,
but like he was smiling and he seemed like he wanted to be friends or something. And
oh, I don't know,
I don't think that we were like interested in anything more than just being like, okay, cool, like we'll just put it to bed.
Right
Wow, it's a real life beef.
Yeah. Oh, I think it'd be like a real whodunit.
Yeah. Nice. And finally, one last thing for you guys. Mm-hmm. So obviously, there's the two of you, and then you know, Jeff, your twin brother Dan.
Yeah.
If you guys were the Emmanuels, who's Rahm, who's Ari, and who's Deke?
Ooh. The extremely high-achieving Chicago-born Emmanuel brothers are Ezekiel Zeke Emmanuel, an oncologist and bioethicist who taught at Harvard Medical School and was the chief of the Department of Bioethics at the NIH and was a special advisor for health policy during the Obama administration. He is now the head of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. His brother, Rahm Emanuel, worked for the Clinton administration, was White House chief of staff under Obama, and is now the pretty reviled mayor of Chicago. Seriously, everybody both on the right and the left kind of can't stand him. Ari Emanuel, the youngest, is a powerful Hollywood agent and is the co-CEO of William Morris. He is also the inspiration for his namesake, Entourage's Ari Gold.
No indies, E. Think of it like the Holocaust. Never again.
Ooh. Okay. I would say Dan is Rahm.
Wow. You know, I was going to say Dan is Zeke.
Why do you think he's Zeke?
Because he's the, I think he's the more.
He's the doctor.
Yes. I think that Dan is the smartest.
Yeah, but Dan's also like, okay, think about Rahm's qualities. Rahm's qualities are that he's like the cutthroat one, right?
Well, yeah, that, yes.
Okay, so that's not me.
He's, right, I would think I'm more of the.
You're more Rahm?
The angry, like, you know.
I don't think you're angry.
Off the handle.
Okay. I mean, you also have all of your digits.
All my digits,
on your hand.
Yeah.
Okay, so wait. So then I am, who am I? If Dan's Zeke.
Right. Then there's Rahm. This right now is us forgetting what the third brother's name is.
Ari.
Ari.
Ari's
right?
The agent. Ari's the super agent.
Right.
Okay,
right,
so.
Right.
Who
am I? I'm Rahm.
Yeah, so you're Rahm.
Maybe Dan is. No, maybe I'm Ari. And
this is maybe not an exact analogy.
I will say this
because there are three of you.
Think about think about which one likes to nap a lot.
We have the. That's Jeff. We have the Brothers Emmanuel book, and that was mentioned in that New York Times piece. And our mom had sent that to us. And when John Caramanico is walking around the apartment trying to get some like idea of like who we were in terms of the stuff that we had in our rooms. When he pointed that out and put it in the article, that might have been our mother's favorite thing ever.
But that being said, so John walks in my room, he picks up the book and he starts laughing, and I go, I still haven't read it. It like literally just came yesterday. And then like it became like a centerpiece of the article.
Nice. And so, you know, obviously you have the Teddy Bear Fresh, the show on February 23rd. Anything else you want to let people know about what? Oh, I can't believe I forgot to mention this.
Yes.
You have the TV show.
Right.
Yeah.
That you announced, you know, it's been a while, maybe since 12, 16 months since you announced it.
"16 months ago, Eric and Jeff made an Instagram post announcing they had sold a scripted TV show to MTV. In an interview at the time with The Fader, they described it as, quote, a hip-hop Louie."
Television is a funny process.
I was going to say, what's going on with it?
Development is a funny process, too. We're working on making this show a reality. Not a reality show.
Yeah.
But making it happen. Mm-hmm. You know, executives come and go. Visions
change.
Yeah. We are trying to stay true to who we are and what we sold, and hopefully there'll be something on the screen soon. But you know, if you told us 12, 16 months ago that we would be still here today without a show on the air, I would have been shocked.
Yeah.
So in any event, we're, you know, developing that.
But I would like to say Rick Ross's album, Mastermind, is in stores.
Yes, go get that. Shout out to Gunplay and Meek Mill and Wale.
Rocky
and,
Fresh.
Yes, Stolly. Shout out to Young Sav. Shout out to
Teacher Moses, mm-hmm. First Lady of MMG.
That's right. Shout out to Wingstop. Shout out to
all the Black Bottle Boys, all the Black Bottle Girls.
Bel Air Rosé in refrigerators now.
Spiff TV.
Yes.
John Jay.
Yes. Everybody on the team, everyone on the squad, shout out to MMG.
And Sav.
We will see you at SOBs on February 23rd. Tickets on sale at itsthereal.com right now.
Longtime listeners will remember that we first talked to Eric and Jeff back in 2013, around the release of their mixtape Urbane Outfitters Volume 1. We got into the history of their very funny sketches and their interviews. I'm so glad they came back and we were able to get into what makes their songwriting, their podcast, and their entire vision hang together. As you heard, they've been consistent from the beginning about putting out material that's funny, but also good enough to stand up to the music that they're satirizing. Join us next week when our guest will be Paradise Gray of X-Clan. We'll talk about his old group, of course, but we'll also discuss his time booking and hosting at the legendary hip-hop club, The Latin Quarter, a time he discusses in his new book, No Half-Steppin', an oral and pictorial history of New York City club, The Latin Quarter, and the birth of hip-hop's golden era. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice. Once you do that, you'll also be able to check out our back catalog. If you enjoy this show, for example, listen to our first talk with It's the Real, back on episode 38. If you use iTunes, it's hugely important to give us a rating and a review. It helps bring more fans and attention to the show. Also, consider helping us out by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a show every single week takes a lot of time and effort from me and Josh, and we really need your support to continue to maintain this level of output. If even a quarter of our listeners contributed just $1 a month, it would go a long way towards making the show sustainable. As an added bonus for our patrons, we try monthly to share some bonus material that comes out when talking to our guests after the main interview is over. Become a patron by the end of February to get access to the March file. If you want to talk to me or Josh about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sataro.
So much. Everything Abercrombie and Fitch.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I still don't understand what they're doing, but at least they're doing it well.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
No, we actually got those from eBay.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Oh, I would say it's second tier.
Special thanks to Patreon supporter Jonas Friedenberg.
Candy for Jews.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.
He's a very chill dog.